if I could break into your conversations and say a very big warm welcome to you all on this summer evening. Now, I couldn't have said that this morning because it would have been morning, but it didn't feel like summer, did it, at about 11 o'clock when it was lashing it down with rain. But it's lovely that we can say it is a summer evening, and welcome to our strawberries and cream as well. And some of you have even dressed like strawberries and cream, so that's good. We've got a few in pink, pale pink. Anyway, it's great to see you all. If you've never been to one of our ladies' events before, then you're especially welcome. But everyone is welcome, and hope you really enjoy this evening. It's particularly lovely, and certainly for me, to be able to welcome our speaker tonight, Julia Bicknell, because she's not only our visiting speaker, but she's also a friend, and we have a very special connection because her aunt used to live in Nottingham, and she was a missionary also for many years, and she used to come along to this church and to our Tuesday fellowship group for the retired. And she was a very special friend, and I loved her very much. And she went to be with the Lord last year, and it almost a year ago we had her funeral here in the church. So I got to know Julia as a result of the contact with Eunice. And so it's very lovely that we're able to have a year on, have Julia with us to speak to us. Now, of course, we all know that communication is everywhere. We're communicating faster and in a more sophisticated way than ever before. And I don't know whether you feel the same way, but it's almost overwhelming. However, I have to confess that communication's got me like a drug, and I can't even break away from my phone to get the screen fixed because it's broken. So communication can get hold of you. But media and information about what's going on in the world, what's going on in our country is so fast, so rapid, it's scary. But we need also to be able to answer some questions about what we hear. Do we believe it? How do we take it all in? How do we process it? And is it possible to be a Christian and be able to have faith while you're working in the media? And can we have faith in the media? So Julia has worked for many years in the BBC as a journalist and is currently working for a Christian organisation, and she's going to share with us tonight some of her experiences and hopefully point us beyond these things to other considerations about truth. So I'm going to ask Julia to come up now, and we're very thrilled that you're here, Julia.
It feels very strange to have one of these microphones on me. I haven't worn one of these for a few years, actually. I used to wear one quite a lot, so you always feel like you have a sort of hipster thing. It's great to be here. As Sue just mentioned, I'm here partly because I want to honour my aunt, who lived over the road just up until last year. And the first rule of any communication, as Sue was talking about communication, is to know your audience. So I want you to just give me a really quick survey, just so I have some idea of who's in this room, who am I talking to, and in fact in the room beyond, who are watching on the screen. So hello to the people in the next room. Very quickly, show of hands, how many of you listen to Woman's Hour? Either often, sometimes, never? Okay, quite a few. What about Start the Week? One or two, few. You and Yours? Few hardy souls, okay. How about the Today programme on Radio 4? Oh, few, quite a lot more, okay. Five Live, anyone listen? Any sports addicts in the house, right? What about Radio Nottingham, BBC Radio Nottingham? Yeah, few. Classic FM? Quite a few classic. Oh, yes. Okay, now this one will really sort out the sheep from the goats. What about the Sunday programme, which is on very early on a Sunday morning? Oh, gosh, you're the hardy ones, right? You're the ones that get up early on a Sunday. Okay, who lies awake at night and decides that they must use the BBC World Service to get them off to sleep? Okay, a few, right? What about, okay, how about the news channel, television? Who watches, who confesses to, okay, right? And, well, with all of that, thank you very much for letting me into your home without me even asking. I can tell that we're going to be friends. And given that, I should perhaps take a bit of time to tell you my story. And I hope that we're going to have time for me to have some time open for you to ask any question you like at the end. Now, I know we're recording this, and so the journalist in me says, that's fine, I'm very open about what I'm going to talk about. But I also have to just put a little sort of caveat and say, is anyone tweeting? Have you all entered the 21st century and don't see anyone? That's good, because in London now, you have to remind people, you have to sort of say, is anyone tweeting? And have to be careful, because sometimes people mistype and you can be accused of saying all sorts of things you didn't actually say. But also, I just want to say, I no longer work for the BBC. Even when you are working for the BBC, you have to get their permission to even do a talk like this. So I just want to let you know that anything I say is my personal opinion. It's not the official voice of the BBC or anything like that. So I want to make that clear. Okay, well, as you heard, my dad is from Nottingham. He went south to join the Metropolitan Police because he was half an inch too short for the Nottinghamshire Constabulary. My grandmother never forgave him for not marrying a Nottingham girl. She said Nottingham girls were meant to be the most beautiful, and I've just checked that out, and she could not understand why my dad went south and married a woman he met in London. My mum met my dad on his one-off visit to her church. She almost missed him because she did the proverbial. She said to her mum, no, mum, I don't want to come out tonight. I have to wash my hair. So she would have missed her husband if she had stuck to her plan. But fortunately, my other grandmother persuaded her. And I came along within a year of them marrying. And both my sets of grandparents belonged to something called the Brethren, which, if you've never heard of the Brethren, is where I jokingly say I learnt to sit down, shut up, and put my hat on. It was where I first learnt to ask questions. For instance, my Nottingham gran said that we shouldn't wear trousers when we were young girls because it says, I think, in Deuteronomy or Leviticus in the Old Testament, I forbid you to wear men's clothing. And as a cheeky little seven-year-old, I argued with my gran and I said, but gran, in the Old Testament, men used to wear long flowing robes. It doesn't talk about trousers at all. The whole idea, so I was already asking questions when I was a very young girl. I was always challenging. My dad used to complain. He said I was always asking the far end of Meg and how far to it. Now, is that a Nottinghamshire expression? Far end of Meg and how far to it? I think it sounds more like Scotland. But anyway, the idea was I would never stop asking questions. Now, despite all my questions, I grew up in a Christian family, as you've heard, and at the age of seven, with a child's faith, I actually accepted this kind of worldview that I was being presented as I was growing up. But because I'm a questioner, I have always constantly questioned my faith, especially when I was at university, when I used to sit up debating half the night with these rather nice young men in my room. That was as far as it went, I hasten to add. But I did used to argue. I wanted to argue all of... And, of course, when you go off to university, you get the chance to ask about other religions, people. You meet all sorts of people from all around the world. So I've always argued, I've always questioned. But I've never doubted God's presence in my life since that time, when I was 7 years old. However, by the time I was 12... I'd worked out for myself a phrase that is often quoted, information is power. Have you heard that phrase before? Information is power. Well, I had never got a clue where I worked that out from, but I realised that if you gave people information, then you empowered them. You enabled them to make informed choices, and then they could go and do good things with their lives. And somehow I worked out from there at the age of 12 that if I wanted to do that in my life, I had to join the BBC. I didn't know anyone in the BBC. In those days, even more than now, very much more than now because they've stopped it, it was very what they call a nepotistic place. You got in if you knew someone who was, if your dad worked there or if your auntie worked there or something. Well, I had no contacts with the BBC, had no idea how I was going to get in there. And I also had this problem, as I told you, I was brought up with this background of sit down, shut up and put your hat on, which didn't really go very well, because back in the 60s and 70s, many Christians thought that nice girls wouldn't possibly want to go into the sex, drugs and rock and roll culture that was what they perceived to be the media. We're talking, for those of you old enough to remember, we're talking the era of Mrs. Whitehouse and the Festival of Light and all those kind of things. So the idea that me as a nice young Christian girl wanted to go into this was rather shocking to my mum and dad. My dad, as I said, was a policeman. My mum was a nurse, so they were not really sure how this would work. But I had this very strong feeling that God had made me the way I am. He's given me the interests that he'd given me. And that not only did he know what he was doing, but he actually meant me to use them. And so, cutting a very long story short, I managed to get into the BBC. Now, if I had tried to keep my eye on the time, there's lots of stories I want to tell you, but perhaps I have got time to tell you. This was an amazing thing. I was at school. I was doing my... people said to me, you should try and get into Oxford or Cambridge. So basically, I tried to get in and I just failed. I just missed it by one place. They said, we've got 12 places and you're the 13th on the list. So if anyone drops out, you'll get it. And I didn't get it because nobody dropped out. So I was gutted and I went off to work in the local, well, it's now Asda. And I was stacking dog food and very sort of sad about life. But I decided I needed to go and get a job to earn some money. And I turned up at the local employment agency in the local town where I was living. I was living between Southampton and Winchester, if you any of you know, on the south coast. And I said to them, I'll do anything, you know, I just need a job. And they rang me the next day, and this is exactly how it happened. They said, how would you like to work for the Independent Broadcasting Authority? Now, how did that happen? Well, it happened because, I believe God opened the door, but more importantly, the IBA, they had their headquarters in London opposite Harrods, but they decided that being opposite Harrods was very expensive to have your offices. So they had just moved their parts of their headquarters, their finance, their engineering and their personnel departments, down to a little village about 5 miles from where I lived. Now, I didn't know that. I had no idea. But they rang up the next day and they said, how would you... And I remember I was in... Actually, I took the call in my parents' bedroom. I'm not quite sure why I was in my parents' bedroom, but I remember clearly as anything this phone call saying, how would you like to work for the Independent Broadcasting Authority? So off I went, and I went for 2 weeks, and they said to me, I arrived, and I was meant to be a clerk. I was doing typing and filing, and I went to work for this big man. It was like a bear, this man. He was a big man, and he had a big bushy beard, and he welcomed me into his office, and I was only there for 2 weeks, and he said to me, I married a studio manager from the BBC. And I thought, wow. And this thing went through me, and I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to be a studio manager. I had no idea what a studio manager was. I want to be a studio manager. And he said to me, stick around. And I walked down the corridor with him, and this red light went on over a studio door, and I was hooked. I was absolutely hooked. This red light, this is it. This is what I'm going to do. And the only problem was I was only there for 2 weeks. Well, on the Friday of my second week, his personal PA was going to get married. And he came back from lunch on the Friday afternoon before she was just saying to him, her name was Angie. She said, right, Chris, you know, I'm leaving and da-da-da. And he suddenly panics and he thought, oh, my goodness, you're going to be away for the next 3 weeks or 2 weeks. You're going to be on your honeymoon. Oh, my goodness, oh, what shall I do? And I was sitting in the corner and I piped up and I said, well, I can type. And he said, OK, you can stay. So I stayed. This is honestly how it happened. And so I stayed, and I worked with this man, and then I asked him more about how do you get to be a studio manager at the BBC. And he took me home, he introduced me to his wife, and was very encouraging. And he could see that I was really interested in this. And so I ended up working for him for 3 months. And then I went off, to Paris for... these days, you know, you're how many people's children in their gap year go off to Indonesia or somewhere? Well, I got as far as Paris because my dad very wisely said, you can go wherever you like, Julia, as long as you raise the money yourself to pay for it. Well, I got as far as Paris. But I had a wonderful time. I lived in Paris for 3 months and practiced my French. And then I came back and then I was trying to get another job. This was even before I went to university. And I couldn't get a job. My parents by now had moved up. My dad was in the Metropolitan Police. So we'd moved to a new place. We were living in this horrible police house in a place called Staines, which is a horrible place, and you know it. Right, OK, I've got to be careful. And so I couldn't get a job in this local area. And my dad said one day, he said, oh, well, he said, well, there's a what do you call them, recruitment, temping office opposite Scotland Yard where I work. Why don't you go up there and talk to them? So I thought, well, okay, there's nothing around here. So I got the train up to London. I thought, why am I doing this? Why am I wasting this train fare to go to, you know, I have to pay this every day. But I got up to this agency and I said I could type. And they rang me and they said, how would you like to work for United Artists? Now, United Artists is a film company that, you know, when you go to the cinema, I mean, they've all been changed over the years. But so I ended up working in this head office of United Artists just around the corner from Oxford Circus. I mean, I couldn't have organised that. And then I was walking back in my lunch break while I was doing that one day, and I walked past this sign, and it stopped me in my tracks, and it said, BBC Recruitment. And I thought, this is where I want to work. So I walked in, this was in my lunch break, walked into this kind of reception area, and I said, I'd like to get a job with you, please. We're talking, now this is 1970, let me just try and think quickly, 76. And they said, well, everyone was at lunch. There was nobody there. So they said, you have to phone. So I took this phone off the wall and I phoned upstairs into this office. And I said, I'm about to go and be a student for 3 years. They said, oh, we never take students. So I said, oh, okay. So they said, but if you take one of those forms down on the table, fill it out, bring it back, then, you know, you probably won't ever hear from us again. So I said, okay. So I took the form home, filled it all out, took it back the next day. And sure enough, I didn't hear anything. Went off to Bristol University. And the very first weekend I was at Bristol University, I went on an outing and I got chatting to this, it was like for new students to help you feel at home. And I was walking along next to this guy and he said to me, what do you want to do when you leave in 3 years' time? Well, I thought that was a bit strange because I'd only been there about 3 days. And I was very embarrassed and I said, well, I almost didn't want to tell him. But I said, well, actually, I'd really like to work for the BBC. And he said, oh, so would I. Now, he was an engineering student. And so he said, well, you do know that we run this programme by students, for students, on Radio Bristol, BBC Radio Bristol, every week, don't you? And I said, no. He said, well, come along with me. So on the Monday, he took me along to this Radio Bristol. Now, we used to sit at the desks that Michael Burke, Kate Adie, and all these, you know, people I used to watch on the telly sat at in the day. But we'd go in the evening. So the very first week, I went with this man called Andrew. And I tell you, it was the era of Sloane Rangers. Does anyone remember Sloane Rangers? They were people who, like Lady Di, they all sort of wore kind of pearls and frilly collars and they all talked very posh. They all said, oh, Daddy's buying me a Porsche and Daddy's going to take me to Gstaad for skiing and all this kind of thing. And I was really intimidated by these people. These were the university people. But this guy, Andrew, was like a normal guy. And the fact that he took me to this meeting. And so they sat around and they said, OK, we're going to do this programme next week. Anyone got any ideas for what's going to be in this programme? And I piped up and I said, oh, there's going to be a play at the Bristol Old Vic. And they said, OK, you can go and interview the director. And that was it, my first interview. So I thought, oh, my goodness. So I was given this big tape recorder, and I was terrified of this tape recorder. I didn't know how it worked. I didn't know. Anyway, I turned up to this director, this theatre director. Now, he didn't know that I was a student in my first week of university. He thought I was the proper reporter from BBC Radio Bristol. So he was terrified of me because he thought I was his posh. And I was terrified of the tape recorder. So the two of us sat there and no kidding, he had a stammer. Many creative people have a stammer. But because he was nervous, he stammered and stuttered his way through this interview. And I was totally preoccupied with making sure this thing was recording and I didn't know how it worked. And we staggered our way through this interview. And I took it into the man who was running this student program. And I said, oh, I've done my interview. And he listened to it and he said, well, Julia, he said, first of all, it's got to be 3 minutes long, not 35 minutes long. And secondly, you can't, nobody is going to listen to this on the radio because it sounds terrible. This poor man is stuttering. He said, what you've got to do is you've got to learn to cut. You've got to take out all his stutters and you've got to give me 3 minutes, the best 3 minutes. Do you know, I sat there for probably 3 days cutting this interview. And what you do in those days, you don't do it anymore because you have all these programs on your laptop. But in those days, you had to have literally a razor blade and you had this magnetic tape. Many of you will remember these, but youngsters won't. And you cut it with a razor blade. And it was the best lesson I had in how to edit, which, of course, I used to then do every day. Because what they teach you when you join the BBC, they teach you to cut on hard sounds. K, t, p. Whenever you hear someone, whenever you want to cut a word out, to cut down someone's interview. So I staggered my way through this interview, and it went on the air. And that was it. I was on my way. I'd done my first interview. Remember I told you I applied to the BBC in the summer of 1976. So the first year I worked at Radio Bristol. Every week I used to trot down to the BBC. I got better at doing interviews. I got better at learning the tape recorder. I finished my first year of university. I came back to this place called Staines, where we were still living. And they said, I got a job in the local... It was an aircraft components factory, which was really boring. And one day, the phone rang, and it was my mum, and she said, the BBC have been on the phone to you. They want you to go and work for them in Portland Place. And they had found my application form the year before that I had left, and they'd somehow found this form. Now, again, there's nothing I could have done with that. So I went up to the BBC in Portland Place. Now, this is all in the news at the moment because of all these very sad court cases going on. So I was there with all the Radio 1 and 2 DJs, people like Dave Lee Travis and Jimmy Savile. I honestly can tell you, I never noticed anything. I mean, I knew Jimmy Savile was odd, but I didn't know anything. They didn't try it on with me. Maybe I looked too innocent, I don't know. Or maybe that was, I don't know. Don't know what happened, but I can honestly say it was the time of all these Radio 1 and 2 DJs, and I basically became their tea girl. I used to take their tea into their studios when they were on the air broadcasting. And one of them, when I came in one day, he said to me, I wasn't really just taking tea and coffee, I should hasten to add. What I was there to do was take the trails, you know, when they're on the air, they play something that tells you about a program coming up. They say later on tonight you can hear, or tomorrow you can hear. Well, I worked for the man who made those, and then I had to take them and deliver them round to all the DJs. Like Terry Wogan was another one, and Tony Blackburn, and so I take them. But because I was going around the studios delivering these trails, I used to take them to cups of tea and coffee as well, and they liked me for that. So one day, one of them said on the air, he said, oh, he said, has it been raining? Is it raining today? And he said, because Rusty has just come into the studio. Well, he'd nicknamed me Rusty because of my hair. And it stuck. And then the DJs used to talk about me. And then eventually they started into like little chats on the air. And so they would say, you know, a bit like they do today with the weather girl and the travel girl. But we're talking, you know, 1977 here. So I just loved it. And that's how I got in. Then I went back to university. All my friends had heard me. I was like this little minor celebrity amongst my friends. And then I went back to Radio Bristol, carried on doing that for my second year. And then I applied to the BBC in my final year. And they had 24,000 applicants for... No, sorry, let me get it right. 12,000 applicants for 24 places. But I got one of the 24 places. So I do believe God opened those doors. I don't think I could have manoeuvred that so easily. So, getting back to my little notes. Oh, that's right. I was just hearing this morning, I don't know if anyone listens to Saturday Live, but they interviewed Dame Kiri Takanawa this morning. I don't know if anyone heard it. And she was talking about a day, because this was my first job in the BBC, I became a studio manager, the thing that this man had mentioned to me. And the studio manager is the person who, surprise, surprise, manages the studios. So they press all the buttons and they make it all happen. And it's the training ground that many people go through. So people like Esther Ranson was a studio manager, Biddy Baxter, who was on the radio yesterday with Desert Island Discs, who became the editor of Blue Peter. She was a studio manager. There's a long, a long and illustrious line of people who started their BBC careers as a studio manager. But the two most important fun things I did while I was a studio manager was I did the, and this is why Kiria Takanawa, remember she sang at Charles and Princess Lady Di's wedding. And I was on duty that day, and it was a fascinating time because my dad, who by now was very senior in the Metropolitan Police at Scotland Yard, he was actually in charge of the security of the route that, that Charles and I were going to travel. So if you were working on that day and you had to get into a building, they gave you like a little mini, almost like a wedding. It wasn't a real wedding invitation to this wedding, but it was like a, you know, a mock invitation that gave you the pass to go through to security to be allowed to go into the BBC. So I was going into the BBC. And I was, again, I was one of those very scary days, really, because I knew that it was the biggest audience that had ever been for any one event was listening and watching that day. And I was the one, again, going back to my chopping. Do you remember my chopping? Do you remember Lady Di got Charles's names? She got them around the wrong way. Do you remember that? So we had this, you know, we had this thing. So we had to chop up the little bit where she got his name wrong and we had to put it out. And it was going out on the news. It was going out to hundreds of millions of people around the world. And I just had to make sure that I got everything right and I didn't, you know, didn't put the wrong tape on at the wrong speed so she'd sound like a chipmunk and all that kind of thing that happens. So that was me being a studio manager. And but I have to confess, I didn't really set my sights on being on the technical side of radio. I always thought that because of this information thing, I wanted to be more of a reporter and a producer. So I saw an advert in the BBC for a 6 months going back to the local radio station where I'd grown up, Radio Solent near Southampton. And I went back there, and I went back, as I said, initially for 6 months. And I'm going to give my age away, if you haven't already worked it out, by me telling you some years, when I say I was there during the Falklands War. And my first night that I was broadcasting on my own, when they let you on the air on a BBC local radio station, they always start you in the evenings, the midweek evenings, because that's when most people are watching television. So they know that you can make all your mistakes and not many people are listening. And the people who are listening, certainly in those days, it's probably changed now, were the people who were football fans because they used to broadcast the local football matches. So I was told that I had to do this. Basically, they said to me in the morning, OK, do the show. You'll have the reporters down at the football ground. They'll phone in reports from the match, you know, half-time and everything. And then meanwhile, they said to me, take a pile of bright boppy, we used to use the word boppy, you don't hear it these days, boppy music, you know, with a beat, and just play nice music and then have the reports from the reporters at the football and just do that, and then you come off the air at 9:30. You start at 7. Well, I'd already done a day's work, by the way. I'd already been there since 9 o'clock in the morning, but was still starting on the air, broadcasting at 7 o'clock in the evening. And this was the first time I'd ever been let loose with a microphone talking to the people of the area. And it was all going fine until 9:20. And then in walked a man who has carried on being a BBC reporter. In fact, he's been based in Manchester a lot, a man called Kevin Bouquet. And he walked in and he said, Julia, I've got an urgent news flash. I must read it immediately. And I almost didn't have time to say to him, well, what is it? And then he read that the HMS Sheffield had been hit by the Argentinians. And like this cold sort of fear went through my heart because I just thought, oh my goodness, everybody listening to this football match, which was Portsmouth, I should have added, is either married to, lives next door to, or knows somebody on that ship, and I'm broadcasting to them. And I've got all this like bright, boppy music. This is not good. So I called in this young lad and I said, quick, take the keys to the record library, go and get me some different music. And I was trying to think frantically, what could I tell him to get? And honestly, my brain sort of froze, and the first track I thought of was Sailing by Rod Stewart, and I thought, oh, you can't play that. And then the next one I thought of was there's a song by Bread, and it goes, if a face could launch 1,000 ships, and I thought, no, you can't play that. So I was racking my brains thinking, tell David what to get that's nice sort of tuneful music. Anyway, so this guy went off to the record library and he grabbed some music and he came back. And then Kevin and I, while while we were doing this, the manager phoned up, the station manager. He was in his bath, by the way. He was listening to me on the radio in his bath. And he said, "Julia, can you stay local?" Which means don't hit the button to join Radio 2. Or nowadays, they run about several radio stations from one on one thing, don't they? He said, "Can you stay local? I'll send some more people in, send reinforcements." So I said, "Yes, yes." And so Kevin and I carried on between us. I was sort of doing the talking, and then Kevin would be bringing in the news bulletins, because we were trying to phone the Ministry of Defence, phone the local MPs, anybody we could think of to talk to us about what had happened to this ship and, you know, the implications of it. But we knew it was very, very serious, and that I just knew many men on that ship would have lost their lives or been really seriously injured. And so we carried on, and we knew also, as everybody says, people turn to the local radio at a time of crisis or national sort of thing that is a local event. So we carried on and we stayed on the air. Instead of joining Radio 2 at 9:30, we stayed on the air until midnight. So there's me. I've been at work since 9 o'clock in the morning. And then I drove home at midnight and I suddenly realised I hadn't been to the loo for about 6 hours. I hadn't eaten anything, I hadn't drunk anything, but I was just sort of on adrenaline because of the importance of it. And then the very next day, the manager called me in and he said, "We want you to stay." I was due to go back to London, where I was based, but he said, "Would you stay? Because obviously you handled that okay last night." And so I stayed there for another 2.5 years. But it was a moment. Whenever I hear about the Falklands, I always think back to that time. And of course, the next day, all the reporters from London, it was what we call, we have a phrase in the media, we call it big-footed. Have you ever heard of being big-footed? Do you know what I mean by that? So in other words, you're the local reporter and you know the area, you know the people. And then these correspondents come from London and they come in and they kind of stamp their big foot all over you. And they sort of say, you know, "You're my little sort of, you do what I ask you and tell me where the nearest, you know, nearest pizza shop is and tell me how to, you know, get hold of the mayor," and all of that. So we call it big footed. So all the next day, all the media came from London and we were sort of, you know, our part was kind of submerged in a much bigger media, what they call a media operation. But that's what was happening. So that was my sort of baptism. Literally, it was kind of a baptism of fire, really, that night. But after I'd been there for a couple of years, I decided I wanted to go back to London. And I eventually applied for a job on Start the Week. Now, again, show me quickly, who listens to Start, if anybody? A few people. So the thing I learnt on Start the Week was how to deal with celebrities, because Start the Week has a lot of people on who want to basically plug their book. You often get them and they're on there and they want to. And, you know, my sort of observation on celebrities is that the ones who are really the celebrities don't tell you about it or don't promote it at you. I'll never forget a man called Cameron McIntosh, who's a very big... Have you heard of Cameron McIntosh? He's a big West End impresario. Honestly, you would never have known that that man put on Miss Saigon, you know, all these shows in London. He was the most kind of ordinary, nice, easygoing guy that you could imagine. But some other people who would come in, they would sort of, you know, they would sort of treat you like their slave almost, you know. And I really learned the ones who were really, they were really the real deal, were the ones that were the kind of easy ones. I know that's not totally true, but in my experience of working on that programme, and it was 9 o'clock in the morning, it was live. So you have your share of actors, one in particular, very well-known guy, and, you know, you talk to their agent on Friday night and he assures you that, yes, of course, you know, this man is going to turn up in your studio at 9 o'clock on Monday, and of course the man doesn't, and you've just suddenly you've got an empty chair and potentially some empty airtime. And you know, you learnt to know who the ones were that were going to do that to you. And a lot of actors would say, "Well, my dear, I don't get out of bed before 10 o'clock, you know, that kind of thing. It was very frustrating at times, but that was an interesting place to be. And then I moved from there to Woman's Hour. And I don't know if people remember when Sue McGregor used to present it. Does anybody remember Sue McGregor? So I was a producer there during the changeover from Sue to Jenny Murray. Jenny Murray's been doing it since 1987, and Woman's Hour was going through one of its periodic phases when certain themes and issues were very popular, and this was the first time when I found myself really having to sort of stand up for my faith, because it also coincided with my journalistic principles of fairness and balance. I hope it's not too sensitive for anyone, but back in 1987, there was, in the news, it was quite prominent, a man, an MP at the time, a man called David Alton, who's now Lord Alton, he took out a private member's bill in Parliament to say that the latest time that a woman could have an abortion would be at 18 weeks, because it was then, in 1987, it was at 28 weeks. And people like my friend John Wyatt, who's the professor of neonatal medicine at University College Hospital, they were already, in those days, keeping premature babies alive at 22 weeks. So we in Women's Hour, we always used to do these issues that were of relevance to women. We used to have a weekly team meeting when we all sat round in a big circle and we planned the next week's programmes. Now, at that time, you don't hear it so much now because I think it's almost become part of sort of daily life. But at that time, back in 1987, there was this mantra a lot. It's a woman's right to choose what happens to her own body. And it was amazing that as we went round that big circle, it seemed everyone totally believed that. There was no questioning. And it seemed that nobody was questioning the fact there was another side to this, which was, what about the rights of the unborn child? If that child could be, as they would say, viable at 22 weeks, 22 weeks, why were we saying that you could still have an abortion at 28 weeks? It just didn't seem to make sense to me. And I was sitting there and nobody was questioning this. And I remember I just felt, really wanted to pipe up and say, well, hang on a minute. You know, we're the BBC. We always put both sides of the argument because it seems as if I was the only person in the entire room that was even thinking like this. And that shocked me. And just as we were going around, I felt extremely scared to pipe up because I was a very junior producer at the time. I sent up a quick prayer and I said, OK, you've got to help me here, God, because I'm scared to speak up on my own. And at that moment, the woman who was the reporter, going to be the reporter on this story, she was a lovely Jewish woman. She spoke up and she said exactly what I wanted to say. Aren't we missing a whole part of this debate? And I was able to chime in and agree with her. And afterwards, she and I got together and we worked out who we could go and interview because she was actually the reporter. And it ended up being a much balanced piece. And I'm sorry to say that there are times in the BBC when there is this consensus of opinion and even the values that we kind of imbibe. I say that I have the BBC's DNA through me now. But there are some times when people all just seem to sort of have this one mind. And after I'd been at Radio 4 for about 9 months, my boss said to me in my appraisal, he said, your problem, Julia, you smile too much and you're not ruthless enough. Well, that was a bit of a problem for me because I had hopes of becoming the first female director general of the BBC. So it was a bit difficult. So what I started to do was I started sort of scowling at people in the lift in the morning. And I was trying to become this ruthless person. But the problem was I couldn't actually manage it. I couldn't make myself this ruthless person. And what was worse, it wasn't making me ruthless, it was actually making me rather unhappy. Now, how much of that is down to my faith, that I'm this kind of not ruthless person? How much of it is my personality? How much is my upbringing? Well, I don't actually know. But the problem was, in any case, I decided after a while that this was my verse that I adopted. I said, as the Bible says, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose your soul? And it was a salutary lesson because nowadays people all the time talk about authentic leadership, don't they? And they say that you must be authentic in who you are and don't try and pretend to be something you're not. But I'd never heard of that back in 1987. So that's why I'm not the first female director of the BBC, for the record. Now, fast forward to 1991. And by now, I was much more comfortable in myself and my own skin. And I was working on Kilroy on BBC television. Now, who remembers Kilroy? Go on. Hey, okay. So I probably made you some programmes that you watched. Well, that was another testing ground for me as a committed Christian, because there were at least four programmes that I had to work out what it meant to have faith in the media. And probably the biggest one of that was Kilroy was live on the air at 9:20, I seem to remember, and it covered whatever was happening in the news. It was a very fast, reactive programme. And just before, I can't remember exactly the year, I think it would have, I said 91, but I think it was actually not that year. It was the year of Lockerbie. And Lockerbie, if you remember, happened just a few days before Christmas. And I was actually at the BBC Christmas party. We were on this programme, Kilroy. We were having a Christmas party. And somebody walked in and said, there's been a plane crash in Scotland. And I just sort of carried, you know, a plane crash in Scotland. You know, I was at a party. The next morning, my phone rang very early. And one of my closest friends told me that two of our closest friends were on that plane and they died. And they were a wonderful couple. One was Canadian and one was American, and they were actually going home to announce their engagement, but of course they never got there. And then shortly after that phone call, and they lived very close to me, they were friends, I knew them both quite well. I got this other phone call from Kilroy, my boss, saying, Julia, I want to send you to Lockerbie, I want you to get on the train and go now. Well, actually, no, I think I drove. He said, I want you to do a programme from Lockerbie, I think it was tomorrow, either tomorrow or the next day. I want you to organise. I want you to line up all these grieving relatives and people in Lockerbie to do this programme. Well, I got there and it became very clear immediately that I was going to have to do one of two things. I was either going to have to be a relative or a friend, a grieving friend or relative, or I was going to have to be the BBC producer. I couldn't be both because the relatives were kind of kept quite carefully with the group, and then the press and the media were sort of here. And I thought, well, I'm not lying, I'm completely straight. I have lost two friends in this plane crash. I'm very, very upset. So I went with the grieving relatives. But instead of sort of being, hello, I'm from the BBC, I was sort of just talking to them as I was a grieving friend. And I was going around these relatives, and I was being as sensitive as I could to how they were feeling. And obviously I was feeling pretty upset myself, but nothing like the parents and some relatives. I mean, obviously at that stage, people like my friend's parents who were in America were not there, but I'm talking about people who lived in the Lockerbie area who'd lost friends and family in the houses. And so then I realised that if I was going to make this programme, none of these people wanted to talk to the media at all. They did not want to appear on a television programme. And so then I had to phone my boss at the end of that day and say, I'm really sorry, but I'm just not going to force this on these people. They do not want to. And he even said, well, how do you know? Have you talked to them? And I said, well, actually, yes, because my friends died and I've been with the group who are the relatives and friends. So, and I'm not pretending. I'm not making out that I am when I'm not, because I'm really upset. And he said, oh, well, you've got to do it. And I said, well, look, I can't deliver that, but what I can deliver is I can deliver a debate about, you know, airlines, air safety. You know, I can deliver some officials, I can deliver some local government councillors and some police and, you know, people who are involved but not relatives and friends. And in the end, they agreed and they said, OK, that's good. But I just felt I had to be authentic. I couldn't have done that unless I was really a genuine friend to Paul and Sarah. So that was me in that situation. There was another programme that we made, and I was accused of getting my faith in the way of my judgment. And that actually has a Nottingham link, because it was coming up to Halloween, October 31st, and I was the assistant producer, and my producer decided, she said, wouldn't it be fantastic, Julia? Why don't we have, you know, we're going to do a program all about Halloween. Let's have an exorcism on the air. Now, this was live television. And nowadays, I think it would be completely stopped. But she said, oh, you know, no. So she went to the editor and they said, yes, that's a great idea. Let's do this. And I was going, no, this is not a good idea. And I was basically saying to them, you do not know what you're talking about. You do not know what you're doing. This is actually very serious stuff. You can't just treat it like sort of, we're just... This is to do with spiritual powers and everything. And so my editor, he said, Julia, your judgment, your faith is getting in the way. I'm going to take you off the programme. I don't want you to work on it anymore. So he called this young junior woman who was, in fact, answering the telephones at the time. And he said, right, you come and do that. You come and do Julia's job. And this young girl, she was only about, I don't know, 20, 21 or something. She did not have a clue. She didn't know how to start. I'm not kidding. She was looking for, how do you find someone in the church? She was actually looking in the telephone directory trying to find a church. And so I was able to go back to the editor and I was able to argue with him and say, look, David, you have to trust me. You know, I'm not letting my judgment get in the way. I do know quite a lot about this. I know about, you know, how church works. I know what I'm talking about. And I managed to get some very, very good people. I got a writer, a woman who'd written some books. And the Nottingham link is I was looking through these newspaper cuttings about exorcisms, and I found that the man who was then the diocesan advisor in Nottingham was in fact a family friend of ours. So I was able to phone him up and say, you know, can you come on this programme? And in the end, we didn't do an exorcism, but what we did do was we talked about the issues. And fortunately, my editor allowed me back on. But it was a hard one for me, because I was sort of nailing my colours to the mast, really. Another one that I talked to, I thought, well, having done that, they know I'm a Christian, so there's no point in hiding it. And one day, my producer, who was called Miriam, she came to me and she said, oh, we were talking about ideas for programmes. And she said, Julia, I'd really like to do a programme about celibacy. Now, you're celibate, aren't you? Will you be on the programme? How old was I? I was in my 30s by that stage. And so she got me on, and I was live on Kilroy talking about being celibate, which we still have on a video somewhere. If you want to see it, you can ask me later. No. But it was a tough programme, because it was very, very intense. And it was fast. You know, we had to turn it around every two or three days. It was pretty exhausting. Then I jumped and I did something out of the ordinary, which I won't tell you the whole story, but in a nutshell, I had the opportunity to go to Pakistan. And I went because I was doing some research. I won a travel scholarship to do this research. And what I wanted to look at was reproductive health in Pakistan and whether Benazir Bhutto, who had just become the first woman prime minister, whether having a woman prime minister had made any difference to Pakistan or not. And so I was travelling around. I had a fantastic time. I organised myself. And then I decided I got the bug. I wanted to be a foreign reporter, going right back to those early days I told you about, you know, information is power. And so I managed to get myself... Having done my three-month scholarship, I then said to the BBC, will you send me back for another year? I want to go and set up as what they call a stringer, actually. There's degrees of foreign correspondent, and the lowest one is being a stringer. What that means is you string for newspapers and media. And the very first day I went back, there were these tremendous floods up in the Himalayan mountains, and I found myself, even without trying, I found myself on this Pakistani army helicopter flying over these flooded areas over the mountains, and I found myself reporting live from this helicopter onto the World Service, and I just loved that work. And while I was there, I found there was a big issue going on about with Christians in Pakistan, which interestingly is still very much in the news, as you know, today. And back when I was there, back in 1992. There was a whole debate about whether people should be forced to carry identity cards in Pakistan. And the idea was that on the identity card, they would have to put their religion. Well, Pakistan, Christians in Pakistan are already discriminated against. And they were all very afraid that if they were forced to carry these ID cards with their religion, then that would be really sort of solidifying it. So I was reporting about this story, and that took me into the slums, into what they call the Kachi Abadi, in Pakistan, where the conditions these Christians live in were amazing. They were living in graveyards, and some of you I know receive information from some of the Christian organisations, but it was a real eye-opener. What was as scary was within these areas where they lived, and this is, again, true today, I'm sure, is they would have almost nothing, but they would have a big satellite television screen. They would have a sort of television screen. And what they were watching, this is back in 1992, they were watching Dallas and Dynasty. And I was just sitting there, you know, with nothing. They had almost no possessions except this television screen. And they were watching, who's that woman that used to be on Dallas with the big padded shoulders? You know, they'd see those kind of houses and those kind of cars. And I was just sitting there with them, interviewing them about this news, and I was just thinking, this is just ridiculous. You know, that here we are in this world where these people have nothing and they're living amongst graves set in a cemetery, and yet they have these sort of shacks with a big television, and they're getting this American imports. It really shocked me. So I did that for a year, and then the BBC said to me, You have to choose with either your job back in London or you stay in Pakistan. And for various reasons, I decided to go back to London. But now I managed to get a role as a reporter on the BBC News in London because I'd got this experience in Pakistan. And of course, they start you off on the worst possible shifts, 9 p.m. to 9 a.m., three on, three off. So you do every three nights, three off, three on again, three off. But it was an amazing time because I was the reporter. You know when you see on the breakfast television or whatever, you see these ministers getting out of their cars or going into their house? I was one of those, you know, what they call the doorsteppers. You know, minister, can you just tell us? Well, I had to go and do that. And I found that was where I learned how what they call the press pack operates and how there is a real difference between... The BBC journalists and the sort of the and the tabloid newspapers. I mean, you've heard a lot of this in the news more recently, you know, about the phone hacking scandals and everything. But I actually saw the way the tabloid journalists would work, and the worst moment for me was when I saw it was a story about a boxer. He'd been in a match and he'd been hit so badly in the head that he was in a coma and they were talking about brain injury. So he was in the London hospital and I was sent off because it was what was happening that morning or that night rather. And I had to go to this hospital to report about his condition. And I got there and these tabloid reporters, no kidding, they were dressing, they wouldn't be able to do this today. We are talking back in the mid 90s. Because now they all have to wear these lanyard IDs and things. But in those days, these reporters had actually dressed up in white hospital overalls and they'd managed to get up onto the ward where he was, this boxer, so that they could interview people and try and find out. I mean, that kind of thing, it would not happen today, but it was happening. And I realised that I wasn't very good at lying. All that stuff I'd told you before, I wasn't very good at being ruthless and I wasn't terribly good at lying either, especially for the sake of a story. However, at this point, God dealt me a bit of a punch too, because there I was, the BBC News reporter. People used to hear me on the news. People would phone me up and say, oh, I heard you on the news today. And at this point, we're now talking 1995. I had a phone call from my brother. And my brother said that, Julia, they're going to launch this Christian radio station called Premier, and they'd like to talk to you. And he said to me, they don't really want to poach people like you away from the BBC, but they would still like to talk to you. So I thought, well, okay, that's all right. I'll go and talk to this guy. No, actually, the funny thing is, I wrote this program controller, the man who was planning Premier Radio. I wrote him it was just the beginning of emails. I think it was just, yeah, emails were just coming in. I wrote him this slightly rude email where I basically said, if you're such a great radio producer and program manager and controller, how come I've never heard of you? And he wrote back to me and he said, well, you may not have heard of me, but I've heard of you. Will you come and have lunch with me? So I thought, oh, all right, then I better be nice. So I went off to have lunch with this man. And I didn't have any intention of going to work for him at all. But over lunch, I found myself thinking, just like Mrs. Thatcher said of President Gorbachev, I could do business with this man. He was called Mark. But I thought, no, I'm at the BBC. You know, I'm this hotshot reporter. So it was coming up to Christmas again. He offered me to be the first breakfast show presenter. Now, if anyone is in radio and television, being the breakfast show presenter is probably one of the best jobs to have, although you have to get up really early. Apart from that, because that's when most people are listening. So he said to me, I'll give you till January the 4th to make up your mind whether you want to do this or not. And so I thought, okay, there's no chance. You've already said you don't want to poach people like me, so I'll stay at the BBC. It happened that I had a friend coming over from Holland, who's an American friend. She was living in Holland, and she said, can I come over for New Year? And I said, yes, sure, come and stay. And she arrived, and she said to me, this was on about the, I think it was like the 2nd of January, she said, I'd really like to go to church. I really would like to go to this particular church, which people who are churchgoers will probably know the name. It's called Holy Trinity Brompton. It's in Kensington. And I didn't go to that church. I went to another church, but I said, okay, if you want to go, that's all right. And do you know, we had a really difficult journey trying to get there because it was snow. It was January the 2nd, there was snow all over London, all the tubes were not working and we had to walk for miles. And I was thinking, oh my goodness, this is a crazy idea going to this church. You know, I don't normally go there. Why are we going? We're only going because my friend's here. And we finally got to this church. We got there late. I think it was one of the first times I'd been. No, I had been there before, but only occasionally. And we walked in and this man was talking, the vicar. And it's one of the only times in my life where I've just felt this, can only describe it as a sense of sort of, it felt like he was talking to me right in here, right in my heart, my soul. And this man was telling a story about how he was a very high-flying lawyer. I was telling Stuart Barlow earlier on, who's helping with the car park, I was telling him that this man, he was working for one of the top London law firms, and he was even a lawyer working on the Rupert Murdoch case, if you remember hearing about Rupert Murdoch. And he felt that God was saying to him, okay, what's more important to you, your status as a lawyer, your salary, all of these things, or following me and being obedient to me? Because what I want you to do, this is what he was saying, this is what the vicar was recounting. He said what he felt God was saying to him was, I want you to give all that up and go into the church. And this man called Simon was basically quite resistant. But as he was telling this story, it was going like this into me. And I was thinking, he's talking to me. It's like there's hundreds of people in this church, but he's talking to me. And he's talking to me about this thing about this radio station that I don't want to go to because I've got my status as a BBC reporter and I've got my salary and I've got my pension. And I just felt this really clear thing in me that I thought, no, I think I've got to be listening to this voice. And so on January the 4th, I wrote to this man, Mark, and I said, yeah, okay, I'll take a year's career break from the BBC and I'll come and help you launch this radio station. So if anyone listens to Premier Radio by any chance, which is still going strong now, however many years later, I was part of that story. No, it's national. You can hear it. Oh, I think it's even on Freeview now or DAB. I know it's on DAB, yeah. And it's changed a lot over the years, but I helped to launch that. The only problem was that after I'd been there, remember I said I took a year out from the BBC? The only problem was that 3 months into that year out, Premier had been very ambitious when it launched. It actually had a financial crisis. And so they couldn't afford to keep me. So they were more or less saying to me, we're going to make you redundant. And I was going, okay, God, this wasn't part of the plan. I mean, you know, I've given up my job at the BBC. That's okay. I understand that. But now I'm going to be redundant. I'm going to not have a job at all because I had got an opportunity to go back to the BBC, but it wasn't for another 9 months. So what was I going to do for 9 months? So I was quite angry with God, I have to say. That was the time in my life where I just felt God was very real to me, even though it was horrible time of year. It was January, February, March, which everyone knows is not a very nice time of year. Didn't have any work, didn't have any money. I felt God was very, very close to me at that time because I felt that even though it hadn't appeared to work out, I was still having to say to him, okay, God, I don't understand what you're doing in this, but I'm just going to trust you. It was also complicated by the fact that I had fallen in love with a guy. I was still single by this, and I was now almost, what year are we talking about? I was coming up to 40. I'd fallen in love with this wonderful guy, and he turned out to be gay. So that wasn't a great... So I felt like everything was not working for me. And at this point, I was like, okay, God, this Christian stuff, you know, I'm not sure that this is quite... You know, if I'm a Christian and I trust you and, you know, I give my life to you, aren't you supposed to give me nice things, not all this rubbish, basically? But through all that, I felt God was really very close to me. I'm not saying it was all easy, because it wasn't. It was tough. It was tough not having any money. It was tough living in my flat trying to find my mortgage every month. But God did honour me, and he did provide. And in fact, that's where I went to work for Classic FM, because a friend of mine who was a Christian was in charge of the newsroom at Classic FM at that time. And so I can't remember how it happened, but we connected, and she said, well, look, if you need work, come and work for me. So I was even been the newsreader on Classic FM for a few months. And I would say that, you know, we all know as Christians, we are not promised life is going to be easy or we're not promised a bed of roses. So I'm conscious of the time. I've got about 2 or 3 minutes to go, and I've still got bits more of the story to tell you. I want to tell you very quickly about 24 Hour News, because some of you watch 24 Hour News. When we launched what is now the news channel, and that was the part of the story I almost missed out. So, as I said, I trusted God, and after I'd worked at Classic FM for a little while, when my year was up, I was able to go back to the BBC and say, well, now you've offered me a short contract to come back. And they said, you've done everything in radio, so would you like to go and work in television? Now, I could have waited a long time to get that opportunity if I'd stayed in radio. So the fact that I'd gone out, worked on this radio station for a few months, and now I was coming back, I just got moved to television. And that's why I ended up helping to launch 24-hour television news. Now, that was really funny, because you probably would never have seen this, but in the early years of what is now 24-hour news, I know they make a lot of mistakes these days, but we made even more in the first few months. And here's a couple of examples. In a nutshell, to explain why we made so many mistakes, what we were doing, we were taking a kind of radio, what we would call like a news production service system, which is very complicated, where the journalists type their stories, and then we were kind of linking it to a massive digital content management server with all the pictures, all the digital pictures. If anyone of you works in the media, you'll know, you'll kind of understand a bit more. The problem is these two systems didn't talk to each other. So we were trying to do things on this system that would make things on that system happen. The only problem was if you made a tiny mistake on this system, this would go wrong. So, for instance, if you typed a dot or a comma in the wrong place in your story, it would make something trigger on the other system. So I'll give you an example of what I mean by that. We had the pictures would be on the screen, and you know the what they call the Aston comes up, which is the person's name who's talking. So if you typed a dot in the wrong place, the next name would pop up automatically. So we once had Madeleine Albright, who was at that stage the U.S. Foreign Secretary, Secretary of State. We this thing popped up by mistake, and it said Scary Spice. And the other problem was that the computer that had all the pictures in it, we took it from a system that had worked. It used to be used for the regional news. You know when you watch the regional news of this area at 6:30 in the evening? We took that system and we said, OK, now we're going to make it run for 24 hours. And the only problem with that was that the computer would get full, and it would eat itself. So it would sort of replace all the pictures that were in there from the morning. So we would have the newsreader would be presenting the story. So she'd be reading a story. This actually happened, and I was in the gallery putting this program out. It was a nightmare. She would read this story about Bill Clinton is in India, and up would come these pictures of a beached whale in Norfolk. And it was like trying to control this crazy thing. And I just did that for months and months. And it was very, very tough. It was 12-hour shifts again, but this time it was 7 in the morning till 7 at night, or 7 at night till 7 in the morning. And after all that, I did that for about a year, and I was looking around, and I wasn't particularly wanting to change or move, but I opened the BBC internal newspaper one day, and again, I had this, I can only describe it as a gut feeling. You know, people talk about gut feeling. I had this gut feeling, and I read this advert, and it said, "Have you produced live radio phone-ins? Do you know about reproductive health? And have you lived abroad?" And I went, yes, yes, and yes, because I'd done my reproductive health in Pakistan. I'd produced live radio phone-ins. And it said, the next line said, "We need someone to go to Hanoi, North Vietnam, to launch radio phone-in programs." And I just had this, I can only describe it as a gut feeling. I wasn't thinking of moving or going to live abroad or anything. I just thought, that's what I'm going to do. And that's what I did. And I went off to Vietnam, had a fantastic time in Vietnam. And again, I saw the plight of Christians, because in Vietnam is a very has a lot of Catholics. And it also has Protestants who were mainly converted by American missionaries back in the 50s. And the Protestant Christians in Vietnam are so, they're almost like invisible. They're almost treated like, I don't know, really second-class citizens. And so coming sort of to what I'm doing today, about 18 months ago, having spent a lot more time travelling around the world, training journalists in developing countries, I came back to this thing that I had felt that I'd seen in Pakistan, that I'd seen in Vietnam, and I just thought, you know, the story of what's happening to Christians, in particularly in minority around the world, is such a big story. I think I need to be telling that part of that story. And again, God gave me this kind of, not quite a gut feeling this time, but cutting a long story short, and this was not the only thing that happened, so please don't think, you know, the next time you think maybe is God nudging you. I call it God nudges you. But I had this, I'd had a series of things happen, I'd had a series of conversations, but the ultimate thing was, I said to the Lord, okay, God, I don't know what you want me to do. I don't know whether you want me to stay at the BBC or go and do this, which is working with my organisation, is headquartered in Holland. And I was walking down this little street in Holland, having visited their headquarters that day, and I was just praying to the Lord as I was walking around the streets, and I just said, okay, I need you to make it really, really clear to me what you want me to do. And I said, I need a sign. I need you to, you know, point from the sky and go, duh, this is what you should do. And I turned the corner, no kidding, there was this massive sign. And I'm not saying this was just the only thing. This was the last thing in a long chain that left me questioning. And it said, Julia. And I thought, is that for me? Do I just ignore that? Shall I just pretend I didn't see that big sign or what? But I did. I thought, no, I think given all the other things, because I don't want to say God miraculously produces a sign with your name on it. He kind of like jumps out from the bushes and says, Julia, do this. But with a lot of other things, and I really want to emphasize that, it really was a number of conversations, a number of things that had happened. I sort of thought, okay, maybe that is supposed to tell me something. So that's what I'm doing now. If I want to put it in a posh way, I could say I'm running a digital niche news agency. I'm a digital, you know, a digital entrepreneur or something. But I'm basically trying to use all my BBC experience as a journalist, as someone who's lived around the world, who's seen the kind of situations around the world, and I'm trying to tell that story online. And I know it won't be everybody's cup of tea, but I think you might have the email address, not the email, the website address. So if it is something that you're interested about, then you can look it up. And if you're into such things, you know, like us on Facebook, follow us, blah, blah, blah. End of talk. Hopefully we have time to either ask me questions or talk to your friends or whatever. But thank you for listening. I appreciate it.
Wow, that was absolutely wonderful to hear. We could have stayed for another hour or two. I'm sure there are so many more stories, but it's been lovely. Now, perhaps we do have just a few minutes for a couple of questions, because I'm sure there are things that some of you would like to ask. But if you could be brief, and then we can get to our desserts. And people might like to come and bring their questions to you personally as well. So is there a question from anyone at all that's sort of burning to be asked? Anyone got a question?
Yeah, okay. And bearing in mind, I'm not speaking on behalf of the BBC. This is purely my personal opinion. I think it... Well, obviously, the way the media has just exploded is very... There's a pressure. And as I said with the example I gave from Woman's Hour, that if you go into any topic and you think you know what the right answer is, if you like. It's actually sometimes quite hard when you're under massive time pressure to sort of think your way around. Well, what are the other points of view? And particularly, it can be very difficult to get I mean, of course, the expectation is that you do it, but the reality is that sometimes it's harder than you think because, for instance, you know, those people aren't available or you don't actually know what's going on. So I would say the BBC tries its hardest. But the other problem is, because of the time pressure, a lot of people, particularly, I mean, you'll all remember the Russell Brand affair. You get very, very young people being put in big positions of responsibility without the training, without the background. And because there's this sort of, you know, like every organisation, it's cutting staff. I just read yesterday, I'm trying to keep it short, British journalists produce, I think it's on average, 15 stories a week. That's, what's that? That's 3 a day, 5 days a week, let's say. So that kind of time pressure means, and that is in the BBC as well, means there isn't time to check. You know, I told you about those funny examples about Madeleine Albright, but I see mistakes a lot on the BBC website, and you just think, like, how does nobody spot that? I sometimes, you know, want to phone them up and say, well, in fact, I did one day, just recently, very, very quickly. You know the story, and this is quite relevant to what I'm doing, you know the story about the Sudanese doctor who's been sentenced to hang, but that's going to wait for 2 years while she breastfeeds the baby. They were saying on the BBC News she had been sentenced to death for marrying a Christian. No, she had not been sentenced to death for marrying a Christian. She'd been sentenced to 100 lashes for committing adultery by marrying someone who's not, you know. But the point is, the journalists were not clear, and it was going out on the air. And I actually sent a note to about 3 of my colleagues, and I just said, you got this wrong, you need to correct it, and they did. So, you know, I think they're fair. They want to get it right, but the pressure is such. And if they don't understand a story as well, it's very easy for them. The problem... Can I keep going? I should keep going. You know, one of the problems is, again, I remember reporting a story about a meningitis outbreak. Now, I can see this lady here. If you're a doctor or something, you immediately know that there are two types of... There's meningococcal meningitis and there's viral meningitis. Have I got that right? Viral meningitis. Now, if you're like me, I'm not a trained doctor. I didn't even know that. You know, I had to make some phone calls and people saying, no, Julia, you need to know. You're a journalist. You're a jack of all trades. You don't particularly know about any one topic. But within an hour, you're meant to become this instant expert and you can't do it. So that's why these things happen. And the problem is a lot of people are experts and they say, well, they're stupid, they don't know that. No, I don't, because I haven't had 7 years medical training.
Thank you.
Well, a very final quick one then. And
really quick, sorry, that was longer. Else? Sorry?
Euthanasia.
I'm as concerned about that as everybody. Again, another of the issues with the media, it's very easy to tell individual heartbreaking stories. So you have the story of someone who is, you know, got multiple sclerosis or whatever, and it's very easy to hear them and hear their story. And of course, everybody feels great sympathy. What's harder to try and explain and convey is the complex arguments of the theological points, if you like, or the spiritual points that need to be put. So again, it's very easy to take someone's story and tell it, and then everyone goes, oh, well, poor person, of course they must be allowed to, you know, take their own life or have someone else take their own life or whatever. So that's another of the problems with the way the media works.
I quite agree. Did you know that in Belgium, children now can make that decision?
No, I didn't. No, that's very interesting. Gosh, no, that's quite... It is, but I think it's up to all of us to be having these conversations with our friends and... Yeah, that's right.
Right, I'm going to
I'm going to bring this to an end. Obviously, there are lots of things on your mind, so do come and have a chat with Julia. I'm sure she'd be really pleased to talk to you. Now, just a couple of things from me, if I may.
Let me go and sit down. I'm sorry to...
Well, first of all, we just want to say a big thank you for coming. It's just been wonderful. So this is just a very small thank you to you. There's a voucher in there as well. As you note, we tried to get the colour scheme to match.
You know what? These are my favourite flowers.
They're calla lilies.
Ah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful, hasn't it?
Really wonderful.